From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Disney has for decades made films with a princess in a lead role, but can that kind of character continue to work in this day and age? Then the lead in the movie Can You Ever Forgive Me is a woman who's over 50. She's a hoarder, an alcoholic, a misanthrope, and her closest relationship is with a cat. Director Marielle Heller said she wasn't taunted.
Hell yeah, give me that movie. I want it. I think that there's something about a character like that, that if it was a male, if you gave that exact same description and it was a man, we'd be like, that sounds interesting.
All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight presenting The Favorite, a tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman as Queen Anne and Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz as the women of the court vying for her favor in select theaters Friday.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Netflix, presenting an original film from Academy Awards-winning directors Joel and Ethan Coen, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, an exploration of life's joys and woes set in the American frontier. Awards eligible on Netflix and in select theaters.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. From the very start of making animated movies, the Walt Disney Company bet heavily on princesses. There's Snow White, Cinderella, Rapunzel, Aurora, Ariel, Belle. The list goes on and on. Nearly a dozen princess iterations currently generate billions of dollars for Disney. And it's not just the movies. It's a never-ending cycle of toys, sequels, and stage shows. But the unrealistic body shapes, the sparkly dresses, and the idea that so many of these princesses just need a prince doesn't really look right anymore. Not that it ever should have. Eric Schwartzel wrote about it this weekend for the Wall Street Journal. And when we spoke today, he started with the most common complaints about Disney princesses.
If you look at some of the classic characters, there's a sort of a passivity to them. Like in Beauty and the Beast, there's some consternation over the fact that Belle falls in love with the man who has taken her captive, essentially. And in The Little Mermaid, Ariel the mermaid decides that she's willing to give up her voice in order to be with Prince Eric. Those are some narratives that, even though they were hits at the time and they're still hits now, in some corners have really raised some issues.
I want to play now a scene from the upcoming movie Wreck-It Ralph.
Have you ever had true love's kiss?
Ew, barf!
Do you have daddy issues?
I don't even have a mom!
Neither do we!
And now for the million-dollar question. Do people assume all your problems got solved because a big, strong man showed up?
Yes! What is up with that?
She is a princess!
I remember seeing this scene at CinemaCon in Las Vegas in the spring, and I, too, was a little taken aback. What's going on in this scene, and why was it so controversial within Disney?
Really, as you can hear in that clip, these princesses are portrayed as incredibly arch, ironic, self-aware, and it's really out of character for a company like Disney, which has always been very protective and very serious about its brand. And so I started asking employees about the scene, and essentially I was told, you have no idea. It turned into a bit of a referendum as to how the princesses should be treated within the company. There are some rules about how these princesses are portrayed, including one that I think will change the way you look at any princess product now, which is that all of the princesses, if you put like let's say four or five princesses on the same lunchbox or the same book bag, you have to animate them so that their eyes are looking in different directions, because there's this long-standing rule at the company that even if they are in the same physical space, these princesses are not supposed to know one another. And so when you have something like the Wreck-It Ralph scene that you played, where they're all clustered together and they all know each other and they're all hanging out, that is like anathema to some people within the company. And I don't want to say it's like a majority, but I think that there is definitely a camp of the more traditional employees who say, look, I'm all about, you know, having progressive, independent princesses, but I have to sell book bags and lunch boxes in every state in the country. So these are massive franchises that have to find, if not a common denominator, then a mix that allows them to sort of tap into that nostalgia for the princesses while also acknowledging that a lot of moms today don't want that classic princess narrative.
You quote one former Disney executive who says this, no matter how hard you try, a four-year-old girl is going to want to be Little Mermaid, but if they try to make Ariel, into a lawyer, there's going to be a huge backlash. So how is Disney trying to figure out that balance? And are there certain films, I'm thinking maybe of Moana or Frozen, where they're trying to bring the princess into the 21st century?
Absolutely. And I actually heard from a lawyer who said, oh yeah, wouldn't it be awful if Ariel became an attorney? Now, it tips both ways, though, because I've talked to folks within the company who say they worry about making those princesses too independent or too strong-willed, because then you might alienate boys, right? You still have to have these movies that need to gross $300 million-plus, right, to turn a profit. They still need to pull in all kinds of moviegoers.
And I think one of the things that a lot of parents liked about Frozen and Moana is that these characters were wrestling with this whole idea of why should we even aspire to be a princess? And it feels like that's exactly what Disney is struggling with, because they can't just let these characters be girls or young women, because in the world of Disney, being a brand character means that you have to be a princess. So how is Disney trying to figure out how they can retain what has sold in the past and what will sell in the future?
I don't get the impression that there's anyone within the company who thinks, you know, let's make a movie about a princess who, you know, stays in the kitchen all day. I think that the arc of the portrayals bends toward the progressive portrayal. However, there are these sort of modulating factors within the company. For example, the upcoming live-action Aladdin movie is going to elevate the role of Jasmine. Jasmine, if you remember in the animated version, really doesn't have too much to do besides, you know, fly the carpet. They did the same thing with the live-action Cinderella that came out about 3 years ago. I talked to the writer, and he told me that actually what he had to do in that movie was deepen the character of the prince, not necessarily of Cinderella, because he said, it really doesn't look good for Cinderella to fall for a guy she doesn't even know. So he had to deepen the prince character to sort of make him worth her time.
I wonder if what Disney might be thinking about, especially as they start taking these animated characters and put them into live action stories, is that they're not so much princesses, but they're superheroes who tend to be female, that maybe Disney is going to borrow more from Marvel than it is from its own animated history.
Also, I think another wrinkle of that is that a lot of young girls are gravitating toward the superheroes themselves. Next year, Captain Marvel, starring Brie Larson, is going to come out from Disney's own Marvel Studios. And we all know that Rey, in the new Star Wars movies, the Daisy Ridley character, she has really been a hit with young women. So I think you will see more young girls sort of gravitating away from the princesses and toward those other characters.
Eric Schwartzel covers the movie business for The Wall Street Journal. He is the author of the article Beauty and the Backlash, Disney's Modern Princess Problem. Eric, thanks so much for writing the interesting story and for coming on the show to talk about it.
You're a prince. Thank you.
I remember Daddy told me.
Up next on The Frame, director Marielle Heller on the making of Can You Ever Forgive Me with Melissa McCarthy.
KVCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, a royal tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, Nicholas Hoult, Joe Alwyn, and Mark Gatiss in select theaters Friday.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Director Marielle Heller's new movie is Can You Ever Forgive Me? It stars Melissa McCarthy as the author Lee Israel. Despite once having a promising career as a biographer, Israel came to be known mostly as a literary forger. In the early 1990s, desperate for money after her books didn't sell, Israel started forging letters from famous authors. She wrote fake letters as Noel Coward and Dorothy Parker, among others, and then sold them to unsuspecting collectors. Israel ended up getting caught by the FBI, and the memoir that she wrote about her life as a forger, also called Can You Ever Forgive Me, formed the basis for the new movie. Can You Ever Forgive Me is the second movie that Marielle Heller has directed. Her first was Diary of a Teenage Girl, which was about a young girl's sexual awakening. It was a passion project for Heller, who struggled to get it made for years. The film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2015.
I think teenage girls scare people to begin with, but I think particularly a movie about a teenage girl and her sexuality and her power was really freaked people out. But for that same reason, I think it's the type of movie we don't have a lot of. And so people who loved it felt like it was made just for them and like it was the movie they had been waiting for. And that's my favorite comment I'll get from a woman who says, that movie was about me. I've been waiting for that movie and you made it for me. And I feel really, you know, it's what you hope for when you're making art, is that people will actually connect to it in their hearts and feel something when they see your movies. So the fact that it had that kind of visceral response for people, where they felt kind of fervently in love with it in a way that was passionate, made me so happy. And it meant that I had a lot of meetings with really wonderful, largely female executives after that, who all said, this was my favorite movie, and then wanted me to make more movies.
It's often very hard for women, out of success even, to make another film. It's weird that way.
It is.
Director's jail for women is almost like Alcatraz. It's impossible to get out of, whereas men get out of it very quickly. But even women who have very successful first features often struggle getting their next film going. How conscious of that were you, and how did you make sure that didn't happen to you?
Well, I was really aware of the statistics that women, the length of time it takes women to make their second feature is so much longer than men. I think the statistic is something like, for men, the average is 3 years to make their second feature, and for women, it's something like 8 years. And I saw it firsthand. I would be at Sundance, and I'd be at the premiere of some amazing, muscular, beautiful first feature, and I would hear people saying, like, well, that was really good, but let's see what she does next, and which is never the conversation about men. You know, a man makes an incredible first feature and everyone goes, I got to be the first one to get him to do the next giant movie. So I was aware that I didn't want to fall into that situation. I knew I wanted to make another movie very quickly. And it had taken me 8 years to make my first one. I didn't want to wait another 8 years to make my second. So when this project came my way, and Ann Carey, who had been one of my producers from Diary, brought me this project, and it had some interest from Melissa McCarthy at the time and Nicole Holofcener, who I knew and respected, and Ann Carey, who I loved and adored, I thought, oh, this is a chance to make a movie with a lot of smart women who are bringing me something that I've never read anything like this. And I felt like it was a character I just had never experienced a character like her in movies. I found her to be so compelling and fascinating. So I jumped on board quickly.
Well, there's a reason why you have never experienced a character like her in movies, and that nobody else has, and that is because this kind of character scares people.
Yes.
And it scares people who make movies and pay for movies.
Yes.
So let's pretend you're the studio executive. I'm going to come in, and here's my pitch for Can You Ever Forgive Me? It's about a woman. She's over 50. Her strongest romantic relationship is probably with her cat. She's bitter. You could call her misanthropic. She's probably alcoholic. She's a hoarder. She's failed in her profession. She's gay. She's not very attractive. And she's a criminal.
Yes.
It's like green light, right?
And I'm like, hell yeah, give me that movie. I want it. I think that there's something about a character like that, that if it was a male, if you gave that exact same description and it was a man, we'd be like, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, Bruce Willis, let's go.
Yeah, Tony Soprano. This sounds like a fascinating person, more connected to their animals than to other people. The smartest person in every room. She's someone who cares about her intelligence and her writing more than she cares about how she looks, which I think is another thing that scares people and scares the industry, because women are known for their looks, and we're only supposed to show beautiful women who look perfect in every frame in movies.
We're talking with director Marielle Heller about her new film, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Let's talk about how Lee Israel got into the situation she is when this film more or less begins.
Yes.
Lee Israel is a very talented writer, and she has written some biographies, and there's something that happens with Estee Lauder that really kind of derails her career. What happens with her biography with Estee Lauder?
She has an unauthorized biography that she's writing about Estee Lauder, and it ends up coming into conflict with what is becoming an authorized biography for Estee Lauder with a different writer. And because she is not somebody who will play the game, and she will not change her writing in order to please people, she ends up really kind of in the doghouse with the publishers, and her book is not well received.
It's a disaster.
It's
Doesn't
a disaster.
Estee Lauder offer to buy out the book and make it go away?
Yes.
And
yes.
Lee says no.
Because that's the type of person she is. And the way she believes her job as a biographer is to tell the truth and to not make her books about herself. It's all about really telling a truthful story about somebody. And she's such a good biographer. She's actually She almost can channel people's voices. She learns about people's personalities through their writing styles and can almost channel them. And that leads her kind of naturally into this criminal activity where she can almost channel the voices of all of these famous writers who she's idolized, the people who really she wishes she was a contemporary of.
But something else happens, and that is, and it's almost like somebody who doesn't have health insurance who has a catastrophic illness.
Yes.
When you're a writer and you're not able to sell your writing, the margin between getting by and essentially risking losing everything you have is razor thin.
No, she is at the edge. She is being told by everyone that she is obsolete. She is no longer a viable writer, and she cannot make a living. She can't get work doing magazine pieces. She can't get work writing copies. She is at the end of her rope, and she's not the type of person who can keep a day job. Lee Israel tried to keep many different types of day jobs, personal assistants, doing paralegal work in the middle of the night, and she couldn't keep those jobs. So she finds herself really not being able to make a living, not being able to make ends meet, and like many artists in New York, she finds herself struggling and she has to go to extreme measures to make ends meet.
I want to ask you about a scene in the film in which Lee Israel, played by Melissa McCarthy, is having dinner with a bookseller, Anna, played by Dolly Wells, mm-hmm. who she is selling forged documents to. Mm-hmm. And there's a suggestion that there's something happening between them.
Oh, yeah.
And this is 1991 New York.
Yes.
One line here was particularly clever, don't you think?
It's wonderful. I love his writing. And Dorothy Parker as well. Caustic wit, you know?
Caustic wit is my religion.
I can't carry it off. You certainly can.
Doesn't help too much in the relationship department.
I'm sure that's not true.
Lee is somebody who's very guarded and does not wear her sexuality on her sleeve. So we talked all about what was not being said. And the context of the sort of code that they spoke in when they were asking each other to have coffee and what that might mean and the things that are being unsaid and the confusion of wanting to know whether the other person knows what you mean when you say certain things, that was the tension of the scene. That's sort of the beauty of the scene. You see these two people who are searching each other's eyes to know if they're thinking what you hope they're thinking. And she's so identified as a writer that not feeling appreciated for her talent was the most painful thing she could possibly experience. And part of what's beautiful about this relationship that starts to develop with this bookseller, Anna, is that Anna recognizes her talent and loves her wit and is a genuine fan of her books. And for Lee, it's like a little glimpse into what could have been, how she could have been regarded by the world, but she isn't. She has never gotten that type of recognition, and it's a true pain for her.
Lee Israel was unapologetic,
yes.
And she didn't worry about what other people thought of her. You're making a movie about a character where you actually want the audience to care about her.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily have to like her.
Nope.
So how do you make sure that you can figure out a path where audiences understand her, even
yes.
if they're not wholly sympathetic to her?
I think the first step is finding an actor who doesn't judge the character. So in casting Melissa McCarthy, she and I met, and we both very much agreed about all of the parts of Lee that we loved. We found her refreshing and funny and witty. She's the smartest person in every room. She moves through the world like a force of nature, and she kind of doesn't care. And there was something about her that we both fell in love with. So having an actor who approaches a character like that with a certain amount of humanity and understands this person inside their bones is key. The risk was, how will people take it? Will people want to see her in this type of role? It's almost like when you go to see your favorite band, you want them to play their greatest hits. You don't want to see them do something different. So I think we were aware that that was the risk we were taking. And I'm just so pleased that people seem to love seeing her in this part. People are so blown away by her performance. She really shines. She's very moving.
Coming up, more with Mariel Heller, who's now directing a film about Fred Rogers that stars Tom Hanks.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix original film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. From the incomparable minds of Joel and Ethan Coen comes a six-part anthology film, original stories that only they could tell. Set against the harsh and unforgiving backdrop of the American frontier, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is an exploration of life's joys and woes. Winner of the best screenplay at the Venice Film Festival, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, on Netflix and now playing in select theaters.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. To track Mariel Heller's career as a director is to note some differences in the film business. Historically, female directors who've had their first features debut at Sundance or other top festivals don't often get the same opportunities to make a second film that male directors do. Heller was all too aware of those stats when her debut feature, Diary of a Teenage Girl, premiered at Sundance in 2015. Now her second film is in theaters. It's called Can You Ever Forgive Me? And it stars Melissa McCarthy. And Heller is actually at work on her third film that stars Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers. Still, the industry is far from parity. Heller's Melissa McCarthy film was just one of two American narrative features that were directed by women at this year's Telluride Film Festival. So I asked Heller what she thinks the role of festivals are in expanding whose films get seen on the most prestigious stages.
Traditionally, film festivals have proven to be more diverse than Hollywood at large. I know Sundance proves to be a very diverse festival, and the year I was there was 50% female filmmakers, and their numbers are so much better than if you look at the numbers of the studio films that are put out. And I do think the film festivals are beacons for women, people of color, LGBTQ filmmakers who are hoping to get their films seen and more widely accepted. We have an industry-wide problem. This is not a festival problem. This is an industry-wide problem. And I think there are many, many ways that we need to be fixing this problem. I know I went through the Sundance Labs, and that was a program that is incredibly diverse and champions the voices of people who otherwise would not have their movies championed. So I think hopefully people are starting to take notice of programs like that and starting to recognize that not only is it important to tell these types of stories, but these are the stories that the public wants. The audience is ready and willing and wants more diverse stories. The fact that I made a movie about a 51-year-old lesbian cat lady and that people are going to see it in droves shows that. I mean, it's a beautiful thing.
So you make this transition from your Sundance film to making a film with Fox Searchlight to now making a bigger budgeted film about Fred Rogers with Tom Hanks.
Yes.
How do you make sure that at every step of the way you remain the director who made Diary of a Teenage Girl?
Weirdly, these projects don't feel all that different to me. It's all the same problems and excitement of trying to work out story, trying to make characters feel authentic, trying to work with actors to make sure the choices they're making feel like the bravest and boldest choices that they can. Part of what I love as a director is creating a space on set for actors to do their best work. I'm an actor. I come from the theater. And part of what I love is breaking down scenes and working on a project from sort of the one word up. And each project, I've been able to do that. I have moments where I stop and go, oh my gosh, I'm giving notes to Tom Hanks, or I'm giving notes to Melissa McCarthy, or whatever it might be. But if I can let go of that and just realize we're all artists together, coming together, trying to be as honest and truthful and brave as possible in our work, it all kind of feels like the same thing.
Morgan Neville made an amazing documentary about Fred Rogers called Won't You Be My Neighbor that I think made a lot of people feel not only nostalgic for Fred Rogers, but also how he has left a void in today's pop culture. What do you hope to tell in this story?
Well, I hope that rather than feeling like Fred Rogers left a void, we can feel the message of kindness and the light which he brought to the world, which I feel still has a lot of power. And by spreading it even further and wider, we can all become better people. I've been in Pittsburgh for the past 4 months. And that's a city that you can feel the reverberations of his heart in every aspect of the city. He is such a present figure in that city where he lived. And I feel myself becoming a better person. I feel myself becoming a better mother. I feel myself becoming just a kinder person within my community because of his teachings and because of his true commitment to kindness and our feelings and what it is to recognize each other as fellow human beings. So for me, in the current climate we're in, where the world feels so desolate and sometimes hopeless, living with Fred's words, spending the past year thinking about how he would feel and trying to let his words guide me has been a joy. It's been a privilege. And part of what our movie is focusing on is the effects that he had on the people who he befriended. It's really from the perspective of a journalist who's getting to know Fred and writing about him, and his life has changed. And we've read thousands of stories of people who had the same experience, which is that as they met him, as his message of kindness seeped into their consciousness, their life changed forever. And I feel, and Tom Hanks and I spoke at one point about how we both feel, that that's happened to us, that by living with his words, we've been changed forever.
And yet, in the neighborhood where Fred Rogers lived, yes, there was a horrible shooting just
hateful
a couple of weeks
tragedy.
Ago.
Tragedy, yes. And it was, I mean, there's nothing to say except for the pain that surrounded that. It's devastating. The community of Squirrel Hill is a community that I've become very close with and feel very connected to, and is one of the most loving, resilient communities I've ever seen. We had a unity event in Pittsburgh last week that we were able to attend, and the spirit of Pittsburgh and their resoluteness about not letting hatred change them as a city is so palpable. I really feel like they are a guiding light in how we should be reacting to tragedy. They are requesting gun control. They are asking for a reform in our policies, which stoke the fires of hatred, and they are also saying we refuse to fall into a pattern of hate. We will be resilient, we will be love-filled, and we will hold each other close through this tragedy.
Mariel Heller, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Mariel Heller's movie, Can You Ever Forgive Me, with Melissa McCarthy, is in theaters now. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.